Thursday, February 6th, we have an informational meeting that is actually taking on more meaning. And I would like to compliment Director Thorne on her impeccable timing. I don't know where you were yesterday.
Oh.
And you would have enjoyed yesterday. Well, you would have enjoyed yesterday. It was informational. But you wouldn't have been able to say everything you wanted to say, and we're interested in hearing that. If we could invite Gene Thorne to the witness stand to continue to talk about the relationships of the health plan and how it impacts other aspects of the DHS budget, we would appreciate it. Gene Thorne, part two.
Part two.
History of the world. Mr. Chair, Gene Thorne, the Director of the Department of Human Services. Actually, I had finished my presentation as such the other day. There were some questions you had asked us to follow up on, and I have some of them. And then I think you just wanted to, like, continue asking me questions and see if I had answers.
Very good.
There's a couple of documents here that we think were the questions you asked. So let me actually, there's a first one that's a chart, front and back chart. And it relates to how does Oregon compare to other states in terms of the percentage of population on Medicaid and CHIP. And if you look down, number 21, Oregon, this is for 2000. We had 11.6%. U.S. average is 11.4. So right in the middle of the pack. You'll see Tennessee up at 22.8. I mean, wow. They've done a huge expansion there with Medicaid. Some other states around us, California at 15%, Washington at 13.6. I'm imagining Idaho's on the back, just because that's normally Idaho 8.3.
Okay.
So that...
Oh, hold on.
Gene, I'm assuming this is with the waiver populations included,
yeah,
right?
This includes our Medicaid and CHIP, including the waiver population. So we are definitely, we're right in kind of basically almost right on the national average. So this was, there were discussions the other day about dollars per eligible and dollars per person if you looked at population. So then the follow-up question was, do we have more people or less people on Medicaid and CHIP than other states? And it appears we're right in the middle.
Well, and functionally, I mean, what this is a reflection of is the state's percentage of population or of federal percentage or federal poverty level they're willing to go to. Say it a different way, it's how much general fund is a state willing to cough up to maximize the federal dollars?
As we said, Mr. Chair, that's right. As we said the other day, the money doesn't come in a block grant. It's you need to put up the general fund, and so it's how much can you or will you put up? I think actually, the information Lynn shared with you the other day, that's actually going to be part of a presentation document, I think, that you'll be seeing when you get to OMAP, that when you look at either cost per eligible or cost per just persons in the state, that Oregon is down lower. It's not that we are especially, as you can see, that we are less generous with the number of people we cover or the percentage of the population we cover. But I think, again, it's a reflection between kind of long-term care of looking at, over the years, how can we do lower cost services and managed care, that I think it does reflect some level of efficiency. I think, and this also was a discussion around provider rates. Our rates in Medicaid in Oregon aren't that much different than probably most of the other states around here. And so I'd like to say it's an issue of efficiency. I think it is, to some degree, a program design that we, both on the long-term care side and on the physical health side, we've tried to kind of put in place the mechanisms that might allow us to stretch our dollars a little further.
Representative Bates.
A couple of quick points, Gene, and correct me if I'm wrong here. This is very interesting because I would have guessed Oregon was higher in percentage compared to states than where it's at, which is close to the middle of the pack. what you don't see here, and you can't put in this right away, but we need to look at sometime, is the poverty level in Oregon compared to other states.
There's only one poverty level. Oh, there's a federal poverty level.
No, I don't mean that.
Percentage of people in poverty,
because that drives your need, okay? Mm-hmm. So if we got 11.6% in the program, but states above us have a higher percentage of the program and less need, okay. That's another fact to look at as far as cost shift is concerned. And also, when you figure we're on an average of 11.6, we're about in the middle of the pack on this thing, and we know that per person we spend less money than almost any other state, then we have an efficient program covering these people. What makes me wonder about this is I know that I see above us, I thought I saw New York above us and California above us, right?
Mm-hmm.
These states are putting in a higher percent of their population to it, and I would guess they are doing what I would hope we'd be doing. They're probably dragging down more federal match for their overall programs.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bates, actually, I think, and I don't have the charts in front of me, but if I remember correctly, California, in terms of the dollars per person, I think it was, in population, was number 51. So what that may say to me, and I know it was this way back in my old days, and I don't know about or my younger days, let me put it, the days when I was in Medicaid before, California covered more people, I mean, they had more people that they covered, and this may reflect also just the makeup of their population, but they had a pretty skinny benefit package under the Medi-Cal program. I don't know how much that's changed over the years, but there were a number of things they didn't, and their reimbursement rates were quite a bit lower than ours. Now, that's old information. That's from the early 90s. But, yeah, they have a higher percentage of their population they're covering, but on a dollars per individual. And I don't that may reflect an issue around rates and benefits.
It would be interesting to wrap that information in one sheet and look at it. It would be instructive. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks.
Representative Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another thing that I would find incredibly instructive is, and I don't know, I think maybe Lynn has this or could get it, is the reimbursement rates in the other states, mm-hmm. and the way they're matrixed, the way they split the pie.
Yep.
Mr. Chair, are you talking about... those seem like two different things.
They are.
Let me get
they
clarification.
Are.
So... And would you be interested primarily in neighboring states like Washington, Idaho, California?
No, I'd like, Ms. Chair, I'd like to get a feel of the country. We talk about incredibly low reimbursement rates here. Neighboring states, I think maybe even some East Coast, some of the, how we compare, for example, to the high reimbursement Medicare states as far as reimbursement rates in the Medicaid, like Pennsylvania, Florida, that sort of thing. And I would also be interested in, I know how we divide the pie here. It'd be interesting to see if there's other pie division models out there, that sort of thing.
Okay. And are you looking at beyond the acute care part, or are you thinking more hospital physician, or do you want to try to get the long-term care piece in there as well? That may... Do you want to think about that?
Yeah.
Rick?
Maybe Rick wants to think about
it. Well, I did see that the center, CMS, did have its old data, states broken out by long-term care, hospital, and physicians in... This is 1998 data at one time we looked at, and... it'd be interesting to see it, if nothing else, if they have more current data, at least in those three categories, perhaps. I think that's how they might collect data from the state, because they seem to have it for all 50, but again, it was rather old. And I think maybe administrative was in there, but they had like three or four categories of Medicaid breakout.
Well, I think, Mr. Chair and Rick and Representative Cruz and everybody, maybe we can do. We'll take a look and see what is available. I do know on the reimbursement rate, something I saw that a couple of months ago, the difficulty, I know, it seems to me I saw a report that tried to compare what are the reimbursement rates, and they ran into a lot of apples to oranges. because they were looking at Medicaid. But we'll see what's out there, because different states have different payment methodologies.
Right.
We, for physicians, we use the base of the Medicare relative value units, where, for instance, and I don't know if you got into this, for an office visit, it may be worth so many units versus something more complicated is more units. We use that, but then we have our own conversion factor. That's Medicare, but we have a conversion factor that's like $25.95 per unit.
Mm-hmm.
Other states who may have an RVU-based, we can at least see what they have. But then within our managed care, we have a different way because there's a different methodology that's used there because the managed care is trying to cover costs. We'll see what's available in terms of how we might compare with reimbursement, and benefits, and also if we have kind of the pie breakout of how what proportion of our Medicaid goes to these various categories compared with some other states. We'll see what's out there.
Okay. I appreciate that.
Thanks. Any other questions? Go ahead.
Okay. There was a second handout, which we think we got some of the questions correct, or maybe we may not have. The first one, how have expenditures in OHP grown over time compared to health care expenditures in general? And what you have here is that starting with 1990, this is an increase index. And so assuming everything, you know, if we start with a base year of 1990, how has it grown over time? And the diamond shape is U.S. medical. The square shape is Portland-Salem medical. And then the round is what OMAP has spent on medical. And so what you can see is, you know, assuming we started out we started from we weren't actually at the same base of what we were paying, but in terms of the increases in 1990, that both the U.S. medical and the Portland-Salem medical are up at a higher level now than OMAP medical. So the OMAP expenditures have actually not grown as much as the medical price index growth has. Now, I was asking Lynn about the spike between 98 and 99 in OMAP medical. That, we think, is primarily, that was after the passage of ballot measure 44 with a 30-cent cigarette tax, and was used for expansion. That's when the CHIP program first became available federally. And so we expanded coverage to children and to pregnant women from 133 up to 170%. I think we only been covering kids under 6 up to 133. So you have kids over 6 from 100% to 170 and pregnant women from 133 to 170. So that's kind of you see a spike there between 98 and 99. But generally, our expenditures are under where we might be if we were just tracking strictly inflation. The second question is down here.
Mr. Chair, before we leave that, does that exclude RX and durable medical and things like that?
No,
or
this is
inclusive?
The OMAP, whether it's fee-for-service or managed care. Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
The one on the bottom I think was probably put on because I gave you the wrong information. Or maybe I said, I think it's such, and it wasn't. What percentage of the medically needy drug budget is for mental health drugs? I had said the other day I thought it was close to 50%. It's not. It's 26.8%. 7/11 is the classification of drugs that are mental health drugs. So that's about how much of the drug portion of medically needy was for mental health drugs.
I'm sorry, Mr.
Yes.
Chair, Vice Chair. You said which is part of the drug?
The medically needy program, which is only
reflected here, is that what you're referring to?
On the bottom here.
Oh, there.
Yeah.
Sorry. Gotcha.
The bottom part of the page. It's not a graph. It's just
okay.
On the back, Representative Anderson asked a question about the coordination of veterans' benefits with Medicaid benefits, OMAP discussed this both with Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which is the federal arm that guides Medicaid and Medicare, and the VA. And CMS says, well, VA is primary, but It has to be reasonably available. And as we looked at what the process is for receiving veterans benefits, they have to enroll, first of all, they have to enroll for VA medical services. Processing that takes from 60 to 90 days. Once they're eligible, they'll be placed on a waiting list to be assigned a primary care physician. In late 2002, the average wait time for the first medical appointment was between 6 months and a year. And then after that first appointment, a veteran is scheduled for specific clinic appointments, and sometimes those appointments are up to 6 months. So based on that and discussions with CMS, we would not be able to deny someone Medicaid benefits to say, oh, it's reasonably available. If they are available and they can get to them, you know, quickly enough, that is primary, and Medicaid is secondary. So I think we'd be in a position, because of the lengths of time it takes to get veterans benefits or to get appointments, that we would not be able to deny access to Medicaid.
Mr. Chair, yeah. Could I follow up on that? The problem that I heard was not that the Veterans Administration patient was not being seen, but rather that he was seeking duplicate care. He was seeing the VA hospital in Roseburg, and then if he didn't like what he heard there, he'd go down to the OMAP doctor in Grants Pass or vice versa, and they just felt that there was quite a bit of duplication in the veterans area.
Why don't I have, Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, what I could do is just to have Lynn or one of her staff follow up directly with you on individual situations.
It just seemed like maybe it'd be good to be able to say, if you're already being treated in one system, you can't go to the other.
So we'll have follow up with you on that.
I can understand the eligibility problem.
Mm-hmm. There was also a question Representative Merkley asked towards the end about the suicides and whether what we knew about those and whether there had been suicides and that were related to some of the reductions. We know there are three circumstances that are under investigation now by the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. Two of them were in Josephine County. One was a suicide. Another was an attempted suicide. They occurred shortly after the persons received notice that copays were beginning for medications. Both individuals have made contact with the mental health system expressing anxiety and concern, but they're looking at it further. My understanding is at least one of them, the person also said, I have high utility bills. So trying to make the direct connection. There had also been an event the third event was in November in Multnomah County. And so this in November in Multnomah County. Okay. So it was before the cuts and even the notices about the cuts had gone out. Apparently the person had met with their case manager. Again, they're in the mental health system. Regarding a change in the frequency of the services that might be available. But again, we're still continuing to investigate that. So three that we are looking at and at this point can't make a direct relationship between it was the notice of owing the call or whatever that may have caused the suicide or the suicide attempt.
Okay, Representative Merkley.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Thank you for investigating that and giving us a sense of it, because it's easy for the rumors to be floating around and nice to know what the real picture is. Thank you.
The other, I don't have it yet, but it seemed the other question that I think you had was you had asked the eligible chart I gave you the other day had the pregnant women and kids all the kind of grouped together as one group of eligibles, and the question was how many of those were really in the mandatory group under Medicaid law and how many were optional. I don't have that for you yet, but we get it. I'll just give it to Rick and he can send it on to the rest of you. Those were the questions that we had track of that had been raised that during the committee that we said we'd look into. So I'm here, I guess, to answer any other questions you might or attempt to answer or tell you we'll get back to you. But if there might be, again, discuss, you know, the my presentation was framed around the role Medicaid plays throughout the Department of Human Services. You haven't gotten into the intricacies of the Oregon Health Plan itself yet, but to kind of go back to the other day, Medicaid is a huge funding source within the department. 75% of our general fund is used to match Medicaid, and it's throughout almost all service elements. And so, again, I guess the point I was trying to make the other day was to recognize that that the health plan is really more than an insurance program, and it does have linkages with those other services and service needs and client needs throughout the department. So as you work on exploring what might be possible to remember to take that into account of recognizing the linkages it does provide for other clients.
Great. Well, I think we've got some more questions. Representing Monis Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, this is public perception that I'm reporting. The more I'm learning about this, the more I realize it's just perception. But one of the complaints I get from constituents is we spend so much money on people that really aren't citizens of the United States. And why am I going to raise my taxes if we're going to just use it on people that aren't paying taxes? When I respond, just to get to be get on the Oregon Health Plan, is there's a proof of residence? Is that correct? Or how? I just need to know so I can better explain what are the actual requirements. And I know we've covered it already, but.
But we haven't in detail. So, Mr. Chair and Representative Monis Anderson, and I think it might be helpful to get you the actual little more detail than what we've provided here. The issue you're speaking of is about citizens. So, okay. We have a person would need to be, first of all, a legal citizen. I mean, excuse me. We're talking about people from outside the country here.
Yes.
Okay. They would need to be a legal alien, first of all, and then for regular Medicaid services. And then beyond that, under the federal welfare reform actions in the mid or late 90s, there were additional requirements put on there in terms of how long they either have. I think it's a combination, I believe, of how long they've been in the United States and a certain number of quarters of work requirements. So we do not, under the Oregon Health Plan, cover illegal aliens. And for those who are legal, it's not just being legal. There are additional requirements beyond that. And so what I should do, though, is it will get you something more specific about those parts of the eligibility criteria.
Follow-up. Those that are not here legally, I'm not sure if how many of those, I think there are, who do get sick and do end up maybe in the ERs or maybe in the public health system. And what are those costs just absorbed by the hospitals then? They don't certainly deny these people.
This is, I was just turning around to Lynn to make sure. The other day we talked about the COWM program.
Yeah, I know that.
Okay.
Yeah.
In that case, a person, if they would meet the lead, even though they may be here, could that include people who are here illegally? Okay. So it could either be legal residents who haven't met the number of years of work requirements or illegal that we would provide the emergency services. And so, again, as we noted the other day, about 75 to 80% of that is for deliveries. So we would pay for the labor and delivery, not the prenatal care. And so, again, as we've defined emergencies, so it's not just a cost shift then. And I would assume most of our costs are hospital costs within that category. But maybe what we could do by the time Lynn comes back to talk with you more is get more detail about the COWM program what, you know, who's covered there, under what circumstances is the money, and what percentage or how much of the money is going to the hospitals, because if they do show up for emergency care in the hospitals will have to cover that. And so what we are doing is providing reimbursement for that.
Okay. Representative Tomei?
Thanks. What I was asking was that I would like to have that information, too. But could you, Jean, talk a little bit more about just your last statement. What program provides the money when for deliveries to the hospitals?
Okay. This is one of the eligible, Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, one of the eligible groups we talked about the other day. They're not in the health plan, per se, but it's called, they're called columns. They were on the second page of
Could you spell that for me so I know what I'm looking for?
C-A-W-E-M, and it stands for Citizenship Alien Waived Emergency Medical. Did I get that? I think I got that right.
Column, okay.
This came in while I was away from Medicaid. And so in the handout the other day that had the pie chart on it, if you get back to page 6, I didn't get it right. They still have to meet the financial criteria and the non-financial criteria of a regular Medicaid program, except for the citizen or alien status. And we only will pay for emergency services, but the Medicaid funding source pays. So at our 62%, 38% match. But it's not, they don't get ongoing care in the Oregon Health Plan. It's Medicaid money. So, again, federal, state money. But it does go just to meet the, it's for emergency medical.
May I follow up, please? Thank you. So, Jean, if somebody, an illegal alien, came to the hospital to deliver, they would have to show something about income? Is that what you're saying?
I think normally what happens is that the hospital gathers that information and then sends. So when they deliver, they're going to deliver. And
right.
But the hospital will gather information, work with the client to gather the information, and then work with our offices to determine whether or not that person actually met the financial criteria and the emergency, of course, labor and delivery would be an emergency. And if, in fact, they did meet the financial and non-financial criteria, then the hospital would be reimbursed for that. If they didn't, if their income was too high or there was some other non-financial, then the hospital would not be reimbursed for that.
And so the hospital would try to get the funds from that person.
Aggressively on these kinds of things to see if someone might be eligible for either the health plan or the specific.
Thank you. Service. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Griggs, Representative.
Either one works. I guess I'm curious as to how you determine whether they're legal or not. Law enforcement's prohibited in the state, and we can't even, our police can't even work with INS. So how do you determine whether they're legal or not?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cruz, before I get into it, because eligibility has never been my arena, there are certain documentation requirements that are required for everyone who applies, and then certain wage records. And I think on this specific question, I'd like to have the eligibility set. And we may have, Senator Minnis had a committee during the fifth special session, and we have, in fact, if this committee doesn't have that notebook, although it may lead you to a whole lot of other areas, but there was a whole notebook worth of information that was put together for that committee, and it may be in there. But we'll get a response back.
Okay. And Ms. Chair, I think this isn't a problem specifically in the Oregon Health Plan. It's a system problem. You get a driver's license, you're eligible for virtually anything, and virtually anybody can get a driver's license sort of thing. So I think that whole issue is going to be before the Judiciary Committee at some point this session. But I'm just curious.
We could go ahead and bring in the copies of the application and the documentation that's required.
Mr. Berkobian.
I mean, unless Rick's got it already, then.
Yeah, I've got all the information from the fifth special session committee in three-ring binders.
Three-ring binders.
I'll contribute it to the committee.
There was a lot of information.
Quite a bit.
Does the committee have any further questions? Representative Bates.
I always trigger things. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, whatever. Chair of Vice, I don't know.
That's it.
Which sounds like a lot more fun than what you're doing. Gene, one of the I know this has been discussed, and I got pulled out a couple times, but one of the sort of, I think, a myth is that people are drawn to Oregon to be on the Oregon Health Plan. I think there's been some studies to indicate that's not the case. I'm not sure if that's true or not. I'm also curious, in Southern Oregon, we commonly see Medi-Cal patients in our offices, and California refuses to pay for those visits just routinely. We don't even bill them anymore. And I wonder if we pay for Oregon Health Plan patients from out of the state, and they get ill or sick. And if that's, and I would expect that's not a significant factor at all.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Bates, I know we do pay contiguous area hospitals, and I'm not sure if it's under an emergency. It's time to bring Lynn up. You have now gotten into an area that
please come up and sign in, please.
Yeah, sign in, please.
Lynn Reed, assistant, acting administrator with the Office of Medical Assistance Programs. I forget my role. In terms of out-of-state providers providing services and whether or not we pay, providers that are within 75 miles of our border are considered contiguous providers, and if they enroll with Medicaid, we will treat them just like an in-state provider. And that way we're able to take residents who live on the borders of the state can take advantage of wherever the natural flow is for receiving Medicaid services. Those providers sign up and they are paid and follow our rules, and so they're treated just as if they were in-state providers. And in terms of farther away from the borders, we only authorize out-of-state payments when it's an emergency service or the service cannot be provided in-state, and we prior authorize. In some cases, some transplants are an example that can't be provided in-state that we would authorize out-of-state.
Thank you. Mr. Anderson.
Are those state mandates or rules, or are those federal mandates?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, those are our state rules, and I don't know, they've always been there for as long as I've been with the program. I don't know if there's some federal requirements that we do this or not. We haven't questioned it because it made sense to us in terms of the natural delivery patterns.
And for Washington or California or Idaho, do they do the same?
Representative Anderson, that may vary. I don't know what their specific rules are. I know that if somebody is enrolled in another state's Medicaid program, they couldn't dually enroll in our program and have us pay for it. But I don't know what the rules of the other state's Medicaid program are related to someone traveling out of state and whether or not they have a contiguous border situation. If that's something you want additional information,
it'd be interesting to know if they're handling their people, our people out of state, like right. We're handling their people. Can I follow up with another?
Absolutely.
I'll pass for right now. I want to think this out.
All right. Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to ask some questions that may have been covered while I was out of town, and if so, the committee can just fill me in and we can short-circuit this. But I wanted to understand better how the calculation works on the money we get from the federal government under Medicaid, whether that calculation's I've had a couple impressions. One is that it is related to the number of people below the poverty index or some index here, mm-hmm. and second of all, what we choose to fund and therefore how the match is generated. Is there a simple way to capture how what Medicaid dollars flow to us?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Merkley, each year, I believe it is, the federal government calculates for each state what they call the FMAP, the federal matching, I know it's the FMAP, but each state may have a different matching rate, and it could go down to 50%, and I think it can go as high as 75%. And it looks back at factors around, I believe it's poverty and employment. So it looks, it takes into, so you will have some southern states, for instance, that may have a very high, it may be 70-some percent matching rate. Oregon, each budget season we're always showing, okay, well, here we've got to change. Either we have to put more general fund in or less general fund because the feds have changed their matching rate. And I think that's done on a yearly basis. They do that. In terms of what, and then anything that is Medicaid eligible for as a service for a Medicaid eligible person is paid using that match rate. So again, we've got to put up the general fund to come up with that. On the Children's Health Insurance Program, is that a consistent 70-30 match, or do that different states? Okay, but the match rate is higher there, and so we have a 70-30 match on the Children's Health Insurance Program, and about a 62-38, and it's a point, you know, whatever, ever, but about 62-38 on the Medicaid match. So again, for those who are eligible, who we can cover, and we are covering, and for the services that are eligible to be covered. Now, the variation on that would be family planning services. We get a 90-10 match on family planning services. And then on the administrative side, most administrative costs are a 50-50 match. We can also get a 75-25 match on what's called skilled professional medical personnel, which means if it takes an RN or a pharmacist or someone to do that job, we get a 75-25 match. We also, for development costs of our Medicaid management information system, we may get a 90-10 match. On the administrative side, generally it's 50-50, but then there are exceptions, depending on it again. But on program, it's for us it's 62-38, and it will go up or down slightly each year based on where the state's been the year or two before.
Which side of those fractions does the state put up? For example, on the 70-30, are we putting up?
Less, the 30, yeah. The
so
state puts
for every
up the preponderance, excuse me, the federal government puts up the preponderance of the money.
For every $30 we put up, we get 70 fed. And back to how that matching rate was calculated, the factors that went into that?
It factors in basically the, and I'd have to, if you want to know the specifics, we'd need to, I'd need to get that.
But
basically, you know, how's the economy doing in your state, and how are you doing in terms of income level in your state compared with other states? And so I think we may have just gotten a notification that our match rate may be going up slightly. Did I just imagine that? And so based on where we've been the last couple of years.
Okay. One more question there.
Follow up.
Related to this issue, I have constituents who are writing about our immigrants being covered, as that's what's driving the costs. The other thing that they're asking me a lot about is to what degree that people are on the plan fraudulently, and what measures do we take to stop fraud or check to see what the double check the accounts, if you will.
Again, Mr. Chair and Representative Merkley, again, I think there's quite a bit of information in some of these binders that were put together.
Okay.
Generally, there are certain, we over the years since the health, now first of all, remember 300,000 don't come in through the health plan door. They come in through another door, or a categorical door. So, for instance, they have to meet the TANF requirements, so there are certain requirements there. But when we actually started the health plan as such, we had a fairly simple process. We said we want to make it easy for people to access. We don't want to put up huge barriers. The application was something like 18 pages before then. We also don't want to have to invest heavily in staff versus getting services out. Over the years, it's been tightened up more and more. And so our staffing ratios for the staff in the central processing branch, for instance, have changed quite a bit over the years. And so there are more initially when we started the program, we didn't have an assets test. And so people could have assets. We then moved to a $5,000. Now you'll see, it's very interesting, we have assets tests. So PEOP has a $10,000 assets test. And really that was part of our initial concern, is we didn't want people to have to use up all their savings in one medical bill, for instance. But over the years, the legislature has, first it was a $5,000, and now it's a $2,000 assets test. And so there's documentation that's required. the agency began, I believe it was about a year, maybe a year to 2 years ago, and did receive some additional staffing to do enhanced verification. And we have, we can look, for instance, at, first of all, the person when they apply, and now I'm just talking about the pure OHP, in the past they showed their last 2 months' worth of income, and then they estimated the current month. Now, because again, if they had a need now, we wanted to know that. The staff will look at, they can look at the employment department's screens, the wage match screens, but the information there is reported on a quarterly basis by employers, and employers have a quarter to report it. So it's not going to give you the most recent data. What they have started to do, though, so that you couldn't do a match there to say, does the information the person's reporting here match, because we didn't have current data. A couple of things have changed. Well, and there was a Secretary of State's audit that was done a couple of years ago now and looked at some of them, because they came in 6 months later and said, and they had the information and said, oh, these people shouldn't have been made eligible. And so trying to see, we don't have the information, but are there some clues that could tip us off? First of all, the workers, when someone comes to reapply, I believe it is, they will look to see, okay, did what they report the first time look close to what, in fact, we now have on file for the employment, from the employment data, or is there something else there that at least tips us off to wondering about this? The other thing we've done is, as of February 1st, with OHP2, we've changed the eligibility. So instead of it, because the Secretary of State's office said, well, one of the things is people may have estimated their current month's income, and they estimated wrong. We now have moved to a past 3 months, so it's actuals that we look at. There is a quality control process that the federal government requires of so many cases pulled on a random sample of so many pulled with full looking at this. We also have, for the lead workers in our central processing branch, certain numbers that are supervised that look at certain numbers of the case files from the staff under them each month. Now, I will also say that, I mean, if a person's going to lie and say nothing ever, and so there's no documentation, we may not be able to catch those things. You get to a point where you can't catch everybody. And the other thing that I think we ran into this last year with the hiring freeze is that as the positions are being held vacant, and there's a lot of turnover in those positions because they're kind of one of the lowest classification of positions. As those turned over, and then the lead workers spent less time on actually oversight and more time on actually processing applications, because we have a 45-day window under federal law in which to process the applications. I'm sure that there are more people who may have come through the system who may not have been eligible if we were able to check every last thing. So, there are a number of processes in place. It does come down to the resources in many cases. So we finally started hiring more staff because we had to put them on swing shift because there wasn't enough room. But are trying to get some of those processes back in place. You do, there's a balance here. How much do you put in administration to catch? And I think that the part of the department that children, adults, and families that works on the eligibility policy, as they try to do an assessment of that at the front end, looking at, I'm not sure what all they take into account, but to try to get some sense of, if we were to do such and such, how much might that cost to do that, and what data do we have that might give us a sense that it would be worth it to do it?
Thank you very much.
Representative Bates.
I think I still remember my question. Yeah, that's quite an answer. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for your information, and I think Lena would probably have to help us with this, a 1% change in the federal match, the 6238 right now, what does that represent in real dollars? I got a figure in my head, but I can't remember if it's correct or not.
Well, if you...
Why don't you give us your number first, Representative Bates?
I don't have...
My memory is $50 million or more. I may be wrong on that.
I think it might be more than that.
It's a huge amount.
Yeah.
I know it's, and that may be underestimating, but a 1% change is, and these figures are set out of poverty in your state, and a slight change makes a huge amount of money flow in a different direction.
We can get back, Mr. Chairman, Representative Bates, we can get back with some sense of, you know, a 1% change in our matching rate. What does that equate to in, for a year or whatever? Up or down?
Representative Jeff, is that it?
Just a couple quick. Thank
you.
Follow-up. I was a little surprised to hear you say something a moment ago that I want to follow up on. An asset test for a FIAP of $10,000 in assets. Does that include group coverage?
I, Mr. Chairman, Representative Bates, I believe so.
Yeah.
I believe for someone to get into FIAP, they can't have more than $10,000 in liquid. We're talking about liquid assets here, something savings accounts, stocks, and bonds. But they have a higher assets test in FIAP than we do in the health plan part.
Follow up. I just make sure I'm clear on this. It does not include the car or the house. Does it include the car or the house for Medicaid?
No, it's liquid assets. Those things that would be savings or... I think many people probably in this income category have stocks and bonds, but it would be things that they could cash out. And so, again, I think the information that is in that one of those three-ring binders would have what all would constitute the kinds of things that would be countable towards that.
Last question.
Sure.
One of the things we discussed in the last session as far as determining eligibility was the workers doing that job. And we had a very difficult time trying to determine if one worker could figure out food stamps, OHP, TANF, or you have to have different people doing all these different jobs, and a lot of people in TANF, and the TANF population is dropping, and not enough on food stamps. You had to hire more people for food stamp people. Can you give us some feeling, if you have it, you may not have been in the job long enough to find out, can we use the same person to do these different things, because often we're dealing with the same client for all three programs.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bates, we do, I believe. I'm glad you had the qualifier. I've only been in the job 6 weeks, you know. So, but if a person comes in to a field office and they're applying for TANF, normally that same worker also deals with the food stamp and the health plan eligibility. But we have, I think beyond that, again, if they come in, I'm not sure how we're staffing on the food stamp side and on, I know we have a central processing branch for the health plan, for many of the health plan people. I'm not sure how the food stamp works. I'll need to find out more about it. That's next week's learning curve.
That's not a priority.
Okay.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gene, I'm following up on some of the questions of Representative Merkley. Years ago, more than I hate to think about, I remember reading studies about people who cheated on welfare and that kind of thing. Actually, the number was very small. So as you've gone through some of these, even though, as you say, you're not going through every one, but you have to do a certain amount in order to get federal funds, what are you finding? What percentage of people actually are cheating on these?
Mr. Chair and Representative Tomei, I'm not sure what the latest figures. It may range, and when I say cheating.
I know.
Knowing our, when I look at those applications, sometimes it's, I would think it's not a, gee, I'm cheating, it's that I didn't understand.
Yeah.
And, you know, it may range from 4% to 10%. It depends. It bounces around. I think, you know, it's interesting because the cash assistance requirements are much more stringent. And, I mean, there's a lot more that you have to do. In the past, I know in terms of looking at someone, do they move to become eligible? I mean, there's a question about do people move to Oregon to get health plan coverage? It's more likely they might have been moving to Oregon from Idaho, for instance, to get cash assistance coverage. And this may not be true anymore, but I know in the early 90s, Oregon's cash benefit was certainly better than Idaho's. I think over the years, too, if you look at some of the programs that have been available in Washington State, but they are going through the same thing right now. The basic health program in Washington is actually covers higher income and more generous benefits than we do now in Oregon under the Oregon Health Plan. So that kind of issue, I mean, the cross-state issue is a little hard to get, and you have to kind of look at the surrounding states as well. But the error rates, I think, may range from 4 up to 10%. And again, it ranges depending on, you know, how much a lot of it has to do with the amount of resources we're able to put on to that.
Thank you.
Committee members, more questions? Representative Anderson.
Remember the question I wanted to ask before, and it kind of tied into across the state lines. If I go to Canada or to Mexico with a passport, I'm legal. I would pay for any services I had down there. If I snuck across into Canada or Mexico, would I have access to any of their care system, as do illegals here?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, that may be, I'm not sure. Canada, you may, I'm not sure. And so I would need to find that.
The unified system of care there.
Okay.
Is there any compensation for those who are nationals from another country? For instance, does Canada reimburse America for any citizens that are cared for here, or Mexico for any of theirs? We just pick up the bill.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, again, there may be a different answer for Canada than for Canada has universal health care coverage, and so it may be, I don't know, it may be that if someone comes here and needs an emergency service, for instance, that the Canadian government would pay for it. I don't know that this, I doubt that the same would be true for Mexico, but that's something we'll need to look into.
Any other questions? All right. Well, thank you, Gene, very much. You're obviously an old timer. You've been on 6 weeks.
Oh, that's
we've only been on the job 4 weeks. So,
you said old timer.
Well, I'm sorry. I didn't mean it that way. A wealth of experience as director.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any further business of the committee? Seeing none, I say we're adjourned.
I'd just like to say you run a more
I've noticed in the audience, I think